listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered radio. Also, solar-powered radio.
Oh, really solar today.
We're broadcasting live from the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa. And you're listening to Writers' Voices, and I'm Monica Hadley, your host, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn, and I just want to put in a happy birthday to Mother. Yesterday, we celebrated her 82nd birthday, went to Iowa City, and ate at the Hamburg Inn, too, where she hung out when she was in college. Yeah,
right. Long time ago.
Long time ago. And she played the piano. They have pianos on the street. That's sort of their summer art installation. And so she sat and played piano there on Lynn Street.
Yeah,
and then
fun.
We went to see Wonder Woman.
Yeah, we had a great day. Great day.
So this is Writers' Voices. Mom, who do we have with us today?
Well, today we have Daniel
Connolly.
And Daniel has, for more than a decade, reported on Mexican immigration to the U.S. South for news organizations, including the Associated Press in Little Rock and the Memphis Commercial Appeal. An award-winning journalist, he has received support from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, the International Center for Journalists, and the Fulbright Program. He lives in his hometown of Memphis, Tennessee. And this book, which is the book of Isaias, has so much information in it that everyone in the United States should read.
It's the book of Isaias, A Child of Hispanic Immigrants Seeks His Own America. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Daniel.
Thank you, and thank you both for having me on.
As I said, this book is so full of information. I mean, how did you gather all this? How long did it take you to gather all this?
So I'm a news reporter, and I've been writing about immigration to the South for years. And this book took about a little over five years of research. And basically, it's a fast-paced nonfiction book. And what I'm trying to do in the book is explain how our country got to this current boiling point on immigration, and also to point out where we're going. So this is a book that's, in many ways, it's about children of immigrants, not just the adult immigrants.
Well, yes, because as you point out, that is the future. That is our future.
Right, and in a lot of states, including Iowa, the Hispanic youth population has grown tremendously in the last several years. I was just looking at the statistics, population statistics from 2000 to 2010, the Hispanic youth population in Iowa more than doubled during that time frame, and I'm sure that it's grown since then. And that's the pattern in a lot of the what you might call new destination states, the states that were not historical destination states for immigrants. And those are the states that I've seen the fastest growth rates in their adult immigrant population, and as well in their population of children of immigrants. And so what I'm arguing in the book of Isaias is that the children of immigrants have tremendous potential. Much of that potential is being lost, and it's in the society's benefit to develop their potential for the good of all.
Yes, and this young boy. Now, did you follow these? It was more than, you reported on more than just Isaias. There were some other individuals in there too. But did you actually follow their progress?
Yes, the way it worked was I got permission to act as an embedded reporter within a school in Memphis. And so I was in the school for a year. I mean, doing things like, you know, sitting in on classes, going to sitting in on private meetings in the guidance office. And then I also interviewed the parents. I hung out with the kids and their families at home, went with them in some cases. For example, in one case, to an attorney's office, to job sites, and in the case of Isaias, the main person I wrote about, he was in a punk rock band, so I would go to their some of their rehearsals and concerts as well. So I ended up in a lot of places that I never anticipated at the beginning I'd visit.
Right, right. Now, his parents did return to Mexico, correct?
They did, yes. Yeah. So that's one of the things I wrote about it. In the very beginning of the Book of Isaiah, I mentioned that he was 18 years old when I met him, and he was considering what to do with the rest of his life. And one of the big factors affecting him was this long-term plan of his parents to return to their country of origin. And I think when we think about immigration to the U.S., we always think of people coming and staying, but historically, not just for Mexicans, but for other groups of immigrants, a lot of immigrants eventually go back to their country of origin. And that was the case for this family that I wrote about, that the parents were quite serious about, you know, doing what they wanted to do in America, earning money, and then going back.
Well, you note that more Mexicans are now going back to Mexico than entering the U.S., according to the Pew Hispanic Center. That's interesting. Right. That's interesting, isn't it?
And when did that start to, you know, when did that switch happen?
Well, the switch happened around the financial crisis of 2007-2008, and it's a little difficult to pin down the exact year, but there were fewer jobs available in the U.S., so less work to attract people. And so, yes, the Pew Hispanic Center, which is quite a reliable organization when it comes to these numbers, has estimated that if you count the number of Mexican immigrants and their kids returning to Mexico, it's actually larger than the number that are coming from Mexico to the U.S., and it's been that way for several years. Now, a lot of the current immigration that you might hear about in the news is actually people not coming from Mexico but from other countries. So, for example, Guatemala, El Salvador, these countries in Central America that have seen extreme gang violence. And so there are a lot of people who've been fleeing that extreme violence. But Mexico is an important country to talk about for immigration because it's the biggest country of origin for immigrants in the U.S. by far. And so it's the focus of my book, and as well as a lot of the other immigration research that's out there.
Well, it's kind of interesting that these last, you know, year politically, there's been last couple years such a anti-immigrant sort of movement, and it's weird that that's coming at a time when this immigration is decreasing.
Right. Well, so, you know, a lot of the things that Donald Trump says are not really based on the reality of what's happening.
And, well, we know it's alternative facts.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is really about creating a feeling of us versus them, exploiting people's fears and anxieties about their place in the world, and, you know, basically scapegoating an ethnic group. And so, you know, some of the things that he says are factual, and then a lot of the things that he says and the solutions he proposes are not based on reality. And so, the idea that, you know, we'll build a giant wall with Mexico, for example, that's one that's, you know, it's something that will give a big, you can get a big cheer at a rally by saying that, but, you know, if you really understand the issue, there are a lot of reasons why that doesn't make sense. Or why it's not the best solution to this problem. I think what I feel the Book of Isaiah does, and what I was aiming to do, was to present how we got here and where we're going. And one of the things that I think is very, is sometimes overlooked is that what we call illegal immigration historically has not been treated as illegal. Our government allowed people to live in this country technically illegally, but practically with limited rights. So the peak years for immigration from Mexico, including illegal immigration from Mexico, were in the early 2000s. And so if you go out and talk to people who are here illegally, a lot of them have been here for many years, you know, 14 years, 15, 16 years. And a lot of them have, you know, small businesses, they own houses, they have kids in school. And so the reason they've been able to stay so long is that our government kind of looked the other way, because when the federal government sent out agents to arrest immigrants at workplaces, that made the employers mad and they complained to the federal government, and in some cases, including in the Midwest, they got it stopped. So there's a classic case in your region, which was in the late 1990s. If I'm not mistaken, it was called Operation Vanguard, but it was an attempt to crack down on meatpacking plants in the Midwest. And frankly, the meatpacking plants didn't like it, and the government backed off.
Right. And then too, the border enforcement, once they're inside the U.S., they weren't bothered anymore. Because it's a very complex issue. It's not black and white. It's not, that's the thing. That's true of many issues. You talked about a scapegoat. We have seen this through history. A lot of countries' leaders need a scapegoat in order to
rally the troops.
Yeah, to rally the troops and promote themselves.
Yeah,
and that's what happens. And
right. Yeah, and I mean, I when I talk about this, I think sometimes people believe that I'm, trying to excuse illegal immigration or say that's a good thing. I see it as a very problematic system. And what I try to say is that, I'm very sympathetic to the individuals who are caught up in this system.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is, significant downside to doing immigration this way. I mean, the immigrants get exploited on the job, and then so they're living here with limited rights. The employers know this. They can do certain things to them that they can't do to, U.S. citizens like me. And then beyond that, the goal of the system is to keep the wages low, and that means that, again, U.S. citizens are affected by that because, why pay, say, a group of U.S. citizen construction workers a solid middle-class wage when you can, pay a group of unauthorized immigrant workers much less, right? So
right.
There are downsides to it, and I'm extremely sympathetic to the individual immigrants caught up in this. But I'm a critic of the illegal immigration system. I don't think it's a good way to treat people.
No,
and it does have impacts for both the immigrants and the U.S. citizens.
And then too, you mentioned in the book IRCA. What was that? Fake documents? Something about that?
Yeah, I think you're referring to the 1986 law.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's an interesting case. So that was under the Reagan administration. It was an effort to regulate this, crazy system that we've been talking about. And so what the government did was it passed an amnesty for a number of people who'd already come to the U.S. illegally. And then it set up a system of checks for those seeking work. So today, for instance, if I or anyone else applies for a job, I have to prove that I have authorization to work in the U.S., that I'm either a U.S. citizen or a legal immigrant with work authorization. So that's the forms that we all fill out. There's been a lot of criticism of IRCA or IRCA, and one of the criticisms is that it created a market for fake documents. The employer was obligated to ask for documents, but not obligated to check that those documents are real.
Oh.
So, when I've interviewed a lot of people who've worked for mainstream companies and they're here in the U.S. illegally, they told me, yeah, I use fake documents to do that. And there's a number of other unintended consequences from that law as well. But by the time that I started researching this, the prevailing thing was basically the government was pretty much, allowing these folks into if they could get past the border defenses, they could stay in the country. But they kind of had limited rights, and they couldn't leave the country and come back. Now, under the new administration, there is more enforcement, and we're going to see how that's going to play out.
Okay. Well, see, that's it. It's so complicated. You can only imagine how difficult it is for immigrants to understand what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do. How it is to become a citizen? Is that a very difficult procedure?
Well, for a lot of people, it is not possible. So, for example, the main person in the book of Isaiah Isaiah Ramos is his name.
Mm-hmm.
He was brought into the country without permission at the age of 8 and has spent more years in the United States than in Mexico. Under current law, his path toward becoming a citizen is extremely difficult, may or may not be possible. He has a temporary protected status now, which is called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and that gives him a work permit and a Social Security card, but not much else. And there's, unless, you know, specific either law changes happen or some other unusual changes in his circumstances happen, there's no real path for him to become a citizen.
Well, you know, his parents started this house painting business, and they were very successful at it. It isn't like all these immigrants are not on welfare. Some people have that idea, you know, that somehow they get on welfare, and that's not true. I think probably majority of them want to work and try to find jobs. Is that not true?
Yeah, I think it is true. I mean, I think that it depends a lot on the family, of course. I mean, you know, there are situations where, for instance, U.S. citizen children are eligible for things like reduced cost meals at school or some type of, you know, food assistance at the grocery store. But, yeah, for the most part, adult immigrants are out working. And in the case of the parents of Isaias Ramos, as I described in the book of Isaias, they were... they had their own painting and remodeling business,
mm-hmm.
And had a lot of loyal clients. And the two oldest sons in the family were working in that business, and the question for Isaias, the middle son, the second oldest, was, is he going to go into that business or is he going to go to college? And so that's one of the central dramas that I was following in the book of Isaiah.
Right, and then they had a younger brother who was born here, so of course he was legal.
A U.S. citizen, that's right.
Yeah, Dustin, yes. Yeah.
And that's one thing that there's still a lot of confusion on that issue. I hear this from a lot of individuals that, you know, there's a lot of misinformation floating out there about this, but any individual who's born in the United States is a U.S. citizen, even if their parents are here illegally. And that's something that, you know, there's still confusion over that point, but it's quite ironclad and quite clear. The courts have held that. So and it's something that creates a strange dynamic. Across the board, if we're looking at Hispanic youth in America, 94% of those youth are U.S. citizens. And that, I think, surprises a lot of people.
Wow. 94% of Hispanic youth in America are U.S. citizens.
That's right. Wow. Yeah, that's a Pew Hispanic Center estimate. And that surprises a lot of people because the ones that we hear about are the ones who are in this deferred action status, like Isaias. You know, those are the ones we might read about on the news, you know, the valedictorian who can't go to college in a certain state because of their status. So we hear about those cases a lot, and I think people assume that that's the majority of Hispanic youth, but it's actually not. It's U.S. citizens like the younger brother of Isaias, Dustin, who's a citizen. And so what that creates is, what I argue is that as a policy matter, it makes sense for governments to support children of immigrants because regardless of what policies are made on immigration, these kids are going to be here for years. They have the legal right to stay forever in the U.S. if they're citizens. And I think it's in everyone's interest to make sure that they have the educational opportunities that they need because more education in general leads to higher incomes, higher funding for Social Security, for Medicare, for taxes, and a better society for everyone.
Well, there's so much confusion about this. And that's the problem, isn't it? Because we have so much misinformation out there,
right? And then of course there are political actors who are trying to convince people of things that are just not true. As we were talking about, there are people who benefit from, you know, whipping up ethnic conflict and you know, using that to try to win votes. So, you know, at the same time, those efforts to whip up ethnic conflict have real consequences for real kids. And, you know, what one of the things that I think is important to point out is that, you know, the immigration fight at the federal level could be, it may continue for years. It wouldn't surprise me if it just goes on for years and years. And in the meantime, school boards and local officials in states like Iowa can do things like hire more guidance counselors to motivate and guide children of immigrants, because you know, after spending so much time with them, that's one of the things that they really need is, in many cases, someone to point them in the right direction in their school, to tell them, hey, you actually could go to college if you do the following things. Sometimes kids, you know, teenagers can be just goofy kids and they're not thinking about the future, mm-hmm. or they may believe that, hey, college is not for me. So, you know, the guidance counselor role can be pivotal, and that, and that's one of the ways that even while this big immigration fight is ongoing, our society could support children of immigrants.
Well, you pointed out that when his school they had a college fair, was it, and the different colleges were there to, you know, tell about themselves and so forth, and they didn't even the kids from his school didn't even get a chance hardly to interact with those people at all.
Right, yeah, there's one scene I read about in the book where the kids from this high school in Memphis were brought to a college fair, and for a variety of reasons, they just didn't get that much time to interact with the recruiters.
Yeah.
It was something like 20 minutes, 20, 30 minutes before they were brought back to the bus. And the contrast I draw is, you know, a more affluent family would make sure that their child had more time,
uh-huh.
more access to the college. I mean, they would, you know, drive them to the college and, you know, have them cast a wide net, look at, you know, I'm going to look at a hard school, like a reach school, and then some easy schools and some mm-hmm. in the middle. But those who are first in their family to go to college, whether they're from immigrant families or not, often don't do that. They don't have a parent at home who's, you know, running their college search process. And so the result of that is a lot of kids who could go to a really good college and thrive in a really good college often end up not doing it. And, you know, I would argue that that's not good for them and it's not good for the broader society, and we should, you know, help these young folks go as far as they can.
And that's that, of course, once again, falls on the guidance counselor at the high school to be able to direct these young people toward a, you know, a productive future, because Isaias was very bright, wasn't he?
Yes, and to, I mean, tell readers a little bit more about him. I mean, he had scored on his ACT test. He got a 29, which is better than, you know, 93% of kids in the U.S. And he did that despite, you know, not having spoken English as a child growing up in Mexico. He learned it in the U.S. And, you know, he was the type of student who would organize a school play with his girlfriend. He was someone that people within the school really looked to
mm-hmm.
And admired, and saw high hopes for him. And so he, however, was ambivalent about whether higher education and college was for him, and he was at the beginning of his senior year considering whether or not to go into the family painting and remodeling business. So at the start of his senior year, his future was very much open.
And so what do you think, why was it that he decided not to go to college? Well, part of it was because his parents went back, I think, to Mexico, and so he needed to run that business. Is that part of it?
Well, his story took a lot of different twists and turns at different times.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to give away too much of the ending. So, you know, I mean, I can just say this. He actually did go to college, but then surprises Fairly shocking events took place, and so I don't want to give away all the surprises, you know, in the narrative. But to your question of, you know, why was he ambivalent about college, it took me a really long time to figure it out. And I think there were, you know, different reasons, but one is his skeptical nature. He's someone who just, for example, he identified as an atheist, and, you know, he's someone who questioned, for example, his parents' religion. They were Catholic, and, you know, he questioned that. And he applied that same skepticism to a lot of different things. And so that was one part of it. And then there may have been an element that, you know, one of his teachers thought that he just didn't believe that it was possible to go to college. That's another thing. And then there was also this element of family obligation, because with his parents talking about going back to Mexico, that would leave him and his older brother Dennis with a fairly massive adult responsibility to look after their younger brother.
Yeah, and run the business, yeah.
I think, you know, he raised this question of how would he balance, you know, working, making money, caring for his younger brother, and going to school at the same time. And so, and he also questioned whether it was worth it. So I think there were a lot of reasons, but the family obligation, I think, played a big role.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Daniel Connolly, the author of The Book of Isaiah, A Child of Hispanic Immigrants Seeks His Own America. Daniel, I want to return to something that you mentioned earlier, which was that currently a lot of immigrants are coming not from Mexico, but from Central and South American countries where they're fleeing from violence. And yet I've never, and maybe there are people out there who are saying this, but I don't hear them ever really looked at as refugees.
Yeah, I mean, the there are a lot of people who've talked about this. One, for example, who a really great writer who I admire, Sandy Nazario. She wrote a book called Enrique's Journey, which I can highly recommend. It's a narrative about a young boy who hops trains and rides from basically from Honduras all the way into the U.S. Crazy story, lots of adventure and action in that, so it's a great book to read. And, you know, she has been an advocate for exactly what you said, you know, treating these kids as refugees. I recently had the opportunity to observe some court hearings in immigration court right here in Memphis, Tennessee, where I'm calling from, and the it's quite a remarkable thing to see. I mean, you would see these teenagers, you know, 16 years old, appearing before a judge who's going to decide whether or not they can stay in the country. And so, you know, they're under a lot of pressure, and it's a strange situation for a kid to be in. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of these young people, if they make it to the border with the U.S., they do claim asylum, and then, you know, eventually a judge in many cases will decide their case, and so, you know, it's kind of a matter of can they prove that they were in danger in their country of origin. And so the refugee story is a little different from the story that I tell in the Book of Isaiah. That's really about the biggest group of immigrants to the U.S., the Mexican immigrants and their kids. And, you know, as I said earlier, I feel like once you read this book, you really come away with the much deeper sense of how we got here on the illegal immigration question, what's at stake for the future of the country, and where we're going.
That's right. That's why I said it's a very important book for everyone to read, because we get so much misinformation, I think you have set a lot of things straight. And
thank you. I appreciate that.
Now, Daniel, when you were embedded in the high school in Memphis, were we starting to get a lot of the anti-immigrant rhetoric and, you know, sort of even hate crimes?
Interestingly, I was in this school in 2012 and 2013, and then I kept up with the kids for a couple of years after that. Okay. So during that time that I was around, I didn't see that much of that. I didn't see that much, you know, it was only at the very tail end of it, for example, 2015, that, you know, Trump opened his campaign by saying that Mexicans are rapists. That was when it was starting up, but during the time that I was in the school, I didn't really see that. And I think one of the things that I'd point out is that people often do get along pretty well. People of different ethnic groups and races frequently do get along pretty well. And, you know, I think this is an observation you can make across countries and cultures, that a lot of the division that forms comes from the top down. It's from people who benefit politically from dividing people. You know, I saw this in something as simple. I used to live in Alabama, and there's a suburb of Birmingham, Alabama, called Hoover. You know, and there was an election I covered for some local race where the people running for office decided that, hey, why don't I run on an anti-immigrant platform? And, you know, that's how a lot of this stuff starts. That's how a lot of, you know, the division gets worked up, is somebody believes it will help them in a political campaign. Mm-hmm. But, you know, on the ground level, if you go into, you know, like multi-ethnic neighborhoods, a lot of times it seems fairly harmonious, and that's what I saw mostly at during the year that I was embedded working on the Book of Isaiah.
Okay, I wanted to return a minute to some of these programs that were started. We talked about the IRCA, the fake documents, and then how about the ICE? What was that?
ICE?
Yeah.
Yeah, they call it ICE. It's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So that's the agency that is responsible for enforcing immigration law and a lot of other laws within the U.S. So, for example, Immigration and Customs Enforcement would investigate a case of something like child pornography, for example. They'll go on the Internet and bust people for that.
Uh-huh.
During the time that I was researching the Book of Isaiah, interior enforcement away from the border in a place like Tennessee or Iowa was pretty light, and now it's stepping up a bit. I'm hearing more reports about immigrants being arrested in places like Memphis.
Okay. Well, that's probably happening because of the
right, change in administration.
Yeah, and people are, you know, when people, they see, they're getting one side of the story. And that's why your book is important, because it tells both sides of the story. And that's, you know, that of course, that's true. That's, we only hear one side of a lot of stories in the world, don't we?
Yeah. Now, Daniel, you mentioned earlier that 94% of Hispanic youth in the U.S. are U.S. citizens, but there was another statistic that you say on here, that one in four young people in America is a child of immigrants.
Right.
That's astounding.
It is, yeah, and that's quite a high percentage, and yeah, it's just an indicator of why this issue matters. Because, again, the children of immigrants have specific needs in many cases that other kids don't have. And I'll kind of go back to the case of Isaiah for a minute and explain what I mean by that. His parents, you know, like many parents, wanted the best for him but didn't know how to help. And his parents came from Mexico, didn't really speak English that well, and they hadn't gone very far in school either. So, for example, his father... The highest grade he completed in school was sixth grade, grade six, and the highest grade his mother completed in school was ninth grade. And so for them, the school system in the U.S. was obviously very foreign, and they didn't know how to navigate it. And I don't know if either of you or any of the listeners have recently been involved in the college application process, but from what I've seen, it's extremely difficult. I mean, there are multiple steps, lots of forms to fill out, lots of options, and it's intimidating even for someone who's highly educated and went to college themselves. And so now imagine someone who doesn't speak English trying to deal with that process for their children. So that's going back to what I had said earlier, that's why I feel that our country should put resources into this, you know, mm-hmm. Investing in guidance counselors, investing in mentoring programs. You know, one of the things I write in the book of Isaiah is that adults should consider mentoring youth themselves. And then beyond that, you know, all of us can fund some of the private entities that are paying for scholarships for these young folks. For example, the Hispanic Scholarship Fund or the group Excellencia in Education. There's another group called the Dream.us. These are organizations that are, you know, putting up money toward dealing with the very serious financial limitations of many families. You know, these colleges today, especially elite colleges, are insanely expensive, you know, in the ballpark of $50,000 to $60,000 a year.
Right.
Even state schools can range from $7,000 to $10,000 for in-state students. And at those prices, many, many families need support.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Well, the old debate about the job situation, and when I forget what state it was when immigrants were rounded up and deported, and then these crops rotted in the fields, and so
that was Georgia.
Yeah. So, you know, it should only have to happen once until they figure out, you know, we just can't do this.
It is, but like you said, Daniel, it is a very complicated situation because, you know, people often say, well, that the immigrants are doing jobs that American citizens don't want to do or won't do. But the reality is they're doing jobs that American citizens won't do at that pay rate.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big debate on that issue. And I think that there's, you know, it's one of these things where multiple things can be true at the same time, right?
So mm-hmm. That's true.
Like, I think, you know, you will hear that exactly from, you know, people in certain industries that, you know, we can't get Americans to do these jobs. But, you know, Americans do hard, dangerous, and difficult jobs all the time. I mean, look at the U.S. military, for example, right? I mean, you get sent to another country, you might be sent into a firefight, you might die, you might get blown up, but people do that. They do it for all kinds of reasons, you know, patriotism, but, you know, the pay and benefits certainly don't hurt. And so the, you know, you can make the same analogy for a lot of different jobs. I mean, would people go into a field and pick vegetables if it paid a living wage with health insurance? You know, I think you'd probably find more people willing to do it, but you know, that's not the reality we have. So anyway, I mean, like, in the book of Isaiah, I don't really try to settle that issue. I just kind of, you know, touch on it and say there are different ways to look at it. But, you know, like I said at the beginning, I feel that what I was trying to do in writing this book was give people a story about, you know, an interesting story about a family and a young people coming of age in America, and by telling that story, I'm, you know, giving a chance to examine all these other issues that are around immigration and around the children of immigrants.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Daniel Connolly, the author of the Book of Isaiah, A Child of Hispanic Immigrants Seeks His Own America. I have to tell you this story, Daniel. I was carrying your book down in Austin, Texas, where I live there part-time. My kids and grandkids are there. And I went into Tom's Market on Barton Springs Road carrying this book. And the clerk, who was Hispanic, saw it. He goes, "Oh, I want to read that." He said, "Everyone's talking about it in the Latino community."
Wonderful.
Yeah, everyone's talking about the current situation?
No, about your book.
Oh, interesting.
Huh. Yeah. He said there were YouTube videos about it.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you better follow up on that. Yeah, great.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, you bet.
But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things is there's just such a, you know, so to tell you a little bit about myself, so I'm white, I'm not Hispanic, but, you know, I'm connected a lot to this world, the Hispanic world. I have a lot of, you know, personal connections to it, and also through journalism, I meet a lot of people. But, you know, I think for a lot of people who are outside of it, they really just have no idea that this world exists, right? And I've seen it a lot in Memphis, just, you know, a lot of ignorance on this topic. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm actually really gratified that Hispanic folks would be interested in the book and in discussing it, because, you know, it, even though I wrote it for everyone, certainly, you know, I'm honored that the Hispanic folks would be interested in it as well. You know, it's had a strong reaction positively from the, you know, from the individuals that I wrote about, as well as from, you know, the broader community.
Now, Daniel, when you went into that school in Memphis, how long did it take you to know who was going to be the kind of the main story of the book, which would be Isaias?
Yeah, so I met Isaias on the second day of school in August of 2012, and basically it was around Christmas that I, or November or December, that I, you know, made the decision that, you know, he would be the main person. And the real reason was that here's a person who has tremendous potential, and it's not clear how he's going to use it. And so that kind of mirrored this broader story that I was trying to tell about America and about immigrants and children of immigrants. And one thing to mention, this is just in case someone's trying to look up the book. I know the name Isaias is not familiar to that many people, and it wasn't familiar to me the first time I heard it. And so Isaias actually had to spell it for me. It's spelled Isaias. And so in case anybody's trying to look for this book, it's the book of Isaias, and again, it's Isaias.
Now, does he pronounce it Isaias, or is it a different pronunciation in Spanish?
In Spanish it would be Isaias, but mm-hmm. at school he would, you know, he and others used Isaias.
Okay.
And at home he had a nickname, which, you know, his brother would call him Chai. That was his childhood nickname. And so, it's only people really, really close to him use that name with him. Mm.
So do you have a section that you'd like to read for us today?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about reading from the introduction, but since I've already said so much about the generalities, I'm trying to think of what would be good. This is kind of a colorful section. This is about how the family came to the U.S. This is from Dennis. Dennis is the older brother of Isaias, and I'm going to read this section about the family's journey to the U.S.
Okay,
so here
good.
We go.
Good.
Let me pull this up here.
This is Daniel Connolly. He's going to read from the book of Isaias.
Okay, so the family has hired a smuggler to drive them to basically to take them across the border and drive them to Memphis. So this is from Isaias and Dennis through recollections. Isaias would only remember pieces of the journey, walking in darkness, seeing strange shapes in the nighttime landscape of the desert, walls, castles, and at one point a racetrack with a Formula One car. He got closer and the racetrack became a cactus in a little ditch. He had imagined it. Dennis would remember more, a stop at a border town to buy supplies, walking at night with a group of migrants, resting under trees in the early morning, the sand beneath him still warm, getting up to walk in the sun, fleeing at the sound of a helicopter, the group running low on water, then stumbling upon a cache of water jugs someone had left in the desert, spending a night in an abandoned, half-burned house, crawling through a tunnel to get from one side of a highway to the other, the sand cold this time, then huddling on the floor of a pickup truck with a crush of other migrants on top of him, learning that the truck was stolen, seeing that the driver turned the ignition not with a key but with a big knife. Christina, his mother, remembered that the border itself was marked by a fence so low she could practically step over it. Mario, his father, said that on both sides of the border, the desert landscape looked exactly the same. It was March, and the temperature in Arizona was moderate, with highs in the 70s. As the temperature began to rise later in the year, migrants died in the heat. That year alone, about 200 corpses were found in southern Arizona. A reporter for the Tucson Citizen newspaper told the story of one man named Alfredo, who searched for the body of his brother Rafa. Surviving migrants had told Alfredo where to look, and after days of seeking, he found a skeleton that wore the same brown pants his brother had worn when he left home. Upon seeing the skeleton, Alfredo vomited and began to weep. The Ramos family arrived at a hotel in Phoenix and rode eastward in a van. The vents in the van blew hot air, which impressed Dennis because in Mexico he'd grown used to vehicles whose heating systems didn't work. It was March and the van slid off the road in snow near Denver. A tow truck pulled it out and they stopped for a day to wait for the snow to melt. Dennis and Isaias played in the first snow they had ever seen. The van that carried the Ramos family rolled east on Interstate 40 across the country. As they left the flatlands of Arkansas at night, Dennis saw a big bridge lit with electric bulbs and beyond it the skyscrapers of a modern metropolis. To Dennis, Memphis seemed like the mother of all cities. So that's how they come to Memphis, and the bulk of the Book of Isaias is about their life in Memphis and takes place years and years after this border crossing. But I always remember Dennis describing that moment as a child of his first sight of Memphis, and it seems like the mother of all cities.
Now, what is there any particular thing that is drawing immigrants to, particularly Mexican immigrants, to Memphis?
Well, you know, I think it was the construction industry.
Okay.
Of course, the construction industry contracted a lot after the recession, but that was a big draw here. And then also jobs in warehouses. In the Midwest.
Meatpacking plants, of course.
That was a big draw. And I'm sure construction as well. I'm not as familiar with the construction industry in your region, but I would venture to guess that probably a lot of people immigrants have come to work in construction.
Mm. Not so and, much in this part of Iowa, maybe in other parts, but I don't see that too much here.
Oh,
a little bit?
Yeah, you know, when they put the bypass in south of our land,
so the
there,
road construction.
Yeah, the guys that put the fence up were all Latino, yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
But, yeah, I mean, I think there's the jobs were the main thing here and across the country. And, of course, now with there's a couple of reasons why immigration has slowed down. I think it's harder to find that type of work, number one. And number two, if we're looking at the biggest country, Mexico, the conditions in Mexico have improved. And actually, if you'll bear with me, I'd like to read something. This is from later in the book when we went to Mexico.
Sure.
So I just to set this one up, I spent some time with Isaias' family members who were in his old hometown in central Mexico. And bear with me one second. Again, I have to...
While he's finding that, I'll remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. We broadcast live Fridays at 1 p.m. on KRUU 100.1 FM and rebroadcast 8 a.m. Monday morning. So if you missed part of this or want to tell your friends, tune in Monday morning, 8 a.m. And we also have our website, writersvoices.com.
Okay. All right, so this part is from chapter 9, and we're walking. I was walking around this Mexican town with Isaias' relatives, and this goes to, you know, why there are fewer people coming from Mexico. Later, we took a walk with Uncle Alberto, and he pointed to a house. He said the parents were simple workers, but they'd managed to send their children to college. One son had become an architect, a daughter had become a lawyer, and another son was studying civil engineering.
Wow.
His argument, you can improve your children's lives without leaving home. Mm. Uncle Alberto had a point. It seemed that everywhere we went in town, we met young people who had gone to college. One of them was a 22-year-old woman who had recently graduated from a university with a degree in political science and public administration. Another married couple was sending their son to the university in Puebla with the funds from the cake business they'd built. It was a typical immigrant success story. Well, minus the part about immigrating. In fact, the mother and cake entrepreneur said the business was what had stopped her husband from leaving the country to go earn money in America, unlike all of her three brothers who had emigrated to the United States. So far, only one brother had come back. So we go on to interview this leading Mexican economist, and he says this. He explained that Mexico's economy had expanded rapidly until the 1980s when it entered long decades of slow growth. Even so, many Mexicans moved out of poverty and became educated. Why? Jaime Ross, the expert, pointed to the demographic bonus, in other words, smaller families. In the late 1960s, the average Mexican woman gave birth to 7 children. But in the 1970s, the government began promoting contraception in smaller families, and birth rates fell dramatically. He said, that's allowed families also to spend more on their fewer children, allowing them to go through school and college more easily than in the past. So that wraps up that section. But I think the point there is that if we're looking at the future of immigration from Mexico in particular, there are a lot of reasons why we're probably going to see less immigration. There will probably be still, you know, significant immigration from Mexico, but probably less, because obviously if you have, you know, people who are going to college, they're less likely to risk their lives to get across the border and come to this country.
Mm-hmm. That is true. Daniel, we only have a few minutes left. Can we talk a little bit about your writing and publishing process for this book?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Where would you like to start?
Start with the writing process. Did you were you writing sort of as you went, or were you researching completely first and then you sat down to write? And how did you sort of structure the book?
Yeah, so I would, you know, what I always recommend to any writer is that, you know, write early, because by writing early you start seeing your weaknesses. So, for example, in this case, I was writing drafts of the book as early as 2010. At that point, it was very limited, you know, very skeletal outlines, but that helped me stay on track. And so I did the bulk of the research in the period of, say, 2012 to 2014. And then in 2015, I focused on writing the book. I took a leave of absence of several months from my newspaper job. Actually, the second leave of absence I took was just to write it, and I, you know, sat in an office for 6 months and wrote it. And so, you know, having that concentrated time really helped me polish it. And, you know, one of the things I always recommend to people is something that comes from a writing coach named Chip Scanlon, and he's a big proponent of his process is, you know, write something really fast, print it out, read it aloud, you'll notice the items you need to fix, mark each item that you need to fix on the paper, and then you fix those items one by one.
Uh-huh.
And this is a process from Chip Scanlon that I have adopted, you know, for everything from short emails to the entire book. And so when I wrote this book, I would actually, at the very end of it, before I turned in, you know, this 80,000-word manuscript, I actually read the whole thing out loud more than once.
Oh, wow. Boy. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you do that, you see your errors, right?
Uh-huh.
You see your the flaws of your work. But, you know, for anyone out there who's listening to this and thinking about becoming a writer, or, you know, writing professionally, that technique really works. And again, it's, you write something really fast, and then you print it out and you fix the problems that you see one by one. Then you print it out from the computer again, fix the problems one by one, and you incrementally make your work better. But the reading it out loud part from paper is essential.
I also, like, I was in a writer's group for many years where we read out loud to an audience. You really catch your mistakes there.
Yes.
And Daniel, did you have a publisher lined up before you started writing, or at what point in the process did you get a publisher?
I got a publisher fairly late in the process. I actually signed my contract with St. Martin's Press it was actually signed in early 2015, and by that point I'd been working on the project for years.
Wow. So, what kept you motivated, not knowing if you would even publish? Or did you just always know that you would be able to find a publisher?
Well, a lot of things, you know, and this is another tip for anybody who's trying to take on a project like this, is I had a group that I called an accountability group. It was friends and family, and every week I would send them an update on the book. This is what I did this week on the book, every Thursday. And so it was like a memo of, this is my progress so far, this is, you know, where I made progress, this is where I'm struggling. And that was a really good motivating tool, because, you know, at least every week I had that to do, and it kind of kept me accountable, kind of kept me going, because I knew that the easiest thing to do would be to quit. I knew that, you know, a lot of people, you know, say if they're writing a dissertation, they just quit in the middle and never finish it. I didn't want to do that with this book, because I really care about the subject. I think it's important, and I thought it was a great story to tell.
Well, we're glad that you didn't quit, and unfortunately we're out of time today. But The Book of Isaiah, as a Child of Hispanic Immigrants Seeks His Own America, by Daniel Connolly. It's available wherever books are sold. And so thank you so much for being with us here today, Daniel.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure, and thank you both for your time and your interest.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Yes, absolutely. And once again, this is a very important book for anyone to read, everyone to read, because this is a subject that's, you know, it's in the news every day, and we need to find out the truth.
And to see how it affects real people.
Yes.
It's not just facts. It's not just theory. It's this is people's lives.
That's right.
Yeah. Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
I do. You know, most people hear what they want, and they hear what they want to hear, and they disregard the rest. And that's why, another reason why this book is so important.
Stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday for Planet Earthwild, and see you next week on Writers' Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.